Welcome to Fire Your Therapist, a podcast with a radical perspective on mental health. Here are your hosts, Carrie and Dan.
Welcome to Fire Your Therapist. Today we're going to talk about how everything we ever learned about relationships we gained from watching sitcoms and going to high school. Right, Dan?
Absolutely. That's what makes us such mature relationship partners. It's why we're all so good at it.
It's such a big influence, right? High school, we learned a lot of survival techniques if we went to traditional high school.
It's true. But all jokes aside, seriously, as a culture, we have some really bad habits for how we find our way into relationships, how we navigate struggles in relationships, how we figure out what's a good relationship and what isn't.
Well, a good relationship is when I find someone who meets all of my needs, right?
Of course, without you having to ask for any of them.
Of course.
They just show up and do all of them.
We shouldn't have to talk about them. I just want someone tied up in a pretty little package who acts the way I want, makes me happy, takes care of themselves. Is that too much to ask, Dan?
Absolutely not. That's completely reasonable. I mean, it better be, because that's what I always ask for.
So. Right. Yeah. No, okay, so jokes aside, I actually think that relationships are the place where we will learn to be in a relationship. I actually don't think you can do it outside of a relationship. I think you need to be with someone or have a really close friend or family member, someone you see regularly enough that you can grow. And I almost don't think it's ever possible to find someone that's going to match you in the way that your, you know, ideas you've formed based on sitcoms, maybe, about like what you want in a partner or whatever.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, but there's this theme happening.
Yeah, there's definitely this theme where we'll struggle in relationships because we're not getting what we want, and we'll write the whole story of what's going on in the relationship and what's wrong with it and what the other person's intentions are for us and that they must not care about us enough because they're not doing X, Y, and Z. And we won't share that story. We'll just share the conclusion. Mm-hmm. We'll just share, well, this isn't working for me, so I'll see you. And somehow it never crossed our mind that we should share any of that story as we wrote it in our head, and that it's just a total social assumption that every possible thing I was aware of, they were aware of, and they meant to not do it for us.
Okay, so I totally jumped over our check-in, so I'm going to pause your thought, and then we'll start there. So we've sort of laid out the show. Is there anything you need to check in with?
No, I'm good.
No? Okay. I'm going to forfeit my check-in, too, but I just want to acknowledge that I remembered.
Good.
And then I'm aware. I'm aware, Dan. Here I am, sharing the conversation, rather than assuming that you didn't want to check in. We're having a meta moment.
Good collaboration. Well played.
So I was thinking, should we check in? And I checked in with you about the check-in. Oh, no, now I've got cross-eyed. Anyway, okay, so you were saying.
But it is a good example, because you could have just as easily, after we recorded this podcast, said, Dan, why didn't you check in?
Right, yeah, no. It does illustrate the point, I suppose. Yeah. No, I see this a lot. Is it about blaming? Is it about making an assumption about someone else's experience and then just deciding, I guess, on your own that that's the truth of the situation?
Right.
Yeah, I've assessed you properly.
I think it's about blame. And it's interesting you say blame, because I was originally thinking this was about vulnerability.
Uh-huh.
Because it takes some vulnerability to share the story you're struggling with, the things you're seeing, the things you're experiencing, what are you trying to make sense of before you share the conclusion. And I'm remembering that blame is often a good protection from vulnerability.
You know, when we're jumping to the conclusion, and we've already gone through a whole mental process about why someone may be doing what they're doing, and we go to that conclusion, when I'm on the receiving end of that, and someone's made that conclusion about me, they have their truth about why I'm acting as I am, I feel cut out of the dialogue, and then it makes me feel, I guess, defenseless or you know, helpless to participate.
Yeah. Well, you are helpless. Your efficacy is being taken out of the relationship. You're kind of now an object in a performance that somebody else has written in their mind.
But tell me about the performance. So how did they assess me? Whoever, you know, how am I assessing someone? It's based on everything I've been through, right?
I suppose. I mean, assessment's a strong word. This is going to sound pessimistic, but I don't think people think it out that thoroughly.
Right.
I think as a culture, we're so obsessed with behaviorism that people, they're in a relationship, they see something happening with the person, and they jump to, well, everybody knows if your partner does X, it means they're A, B, and C, which is just some social story about people.
Right, and it's not including the context of that specific person.
True.
Right.
True. It's also rarely accurate. And once you become a therapist and you hear 50 different people's story about what they think seeing X means, nobody's A, B, and C are the same. But we all think, oh, it's just normal. It's what everybody should do. And it's not really.
It might contribute to why so many of us isolate ourselves when we are going through something, because we might make the assumption that someone else is making an assumption about us.
Right.
And again, cut them out of the dialogue. Say, you can't help me.
Totally.
Because you're going to think this about me, so I'm not even going to bother sharing. Right. I'm not going to bother being vulnerable. Because you know, we can all easily say, this person that I could possibly go to and be vulnerable with, well, you know, they watch a lot of television about...
reality TV.
Right, yeah. And they're going to assume this. So I know what I'm going to get as a response if I'm vulnerable with that. I'm not going to risk that. Totally. So I'm either going to isolate or I'm going to make that assumption in my head and then tell them. And they notice I'm off. Oh, you seem to be going through something, Carrie. You want to talk about it? No.
Right.
You wouldn't understand.
I just remembered something I thought of about what you said at the beginning of the podcast, that we can only learn it in relationships. And I think that's totally true. And it's shocking how often people, they decide they need to be alone and figure some things out about themselves first before they're ready for a relationship. As if you can get better at being in one by not being in one.
Right.
And it's kind of ironic because I think probably you actually get worse at being in them by trying to use your experience not in them. To get better at being in a relationship.
So there's this thing that I always think is helpful when you're in a relationship. I don't know if this applies to anyone other than myself. Here's this little trick I use with myself. I decide that if it's a friendship or a romantic relationship or a family member, I decide this relationship is not on the table for discussion. It is. It just is. I'm in relationship with you. We are in this thing. So we're going to work on it. Now, in my mind, that's taken escape out of the question, right? If it's not on the table, this is just something that's going to be ongoing. I think this is easier to relate to a friendship, okay? Because we've learned that we can lose friends over our lifetime and gain new ones, and there's lots of people out there to hang out with. And if I don't like this friend right now, I have this other one to hang out with. So there's no value placed on the repair. As a culture, there's not a lot of value placed on the repair. And in fact, there's so many examples of this on reality TV, let's say, that the rupture is, what's the word, dignified or...
like it's righteous in some way?
Yeah, yeah. So like the more indignant I am about something that's gone on between us, I can be loud enough or mean enough to earn the right to win, right?
It sort of validates the other person as the bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And it turns into a me against them rather than we're trying to do this thing together. And we don't want to go to that vulnerable place of I need you.
Right.
Like I'm living my life. I'm going to need people to be there for me as I go through significant life events. And there's this storyline out there that people are dispensable. And if you don't perform the way that I want, Dan, you know, I'll just go find another Dan, right?
Right. Yeah, it's such a good point. As a culture, we're so not resilient to rupture.
And again, I am echoing probably myself from another podcast, but I don't think we've had a lot of practice. But many, many examples of how useful it is to just end the relationship. Oh, this is irreparable. It's gone too far.
Right. It'd be great if everybody saw those as opportunities to grow their ability to be in a relationship instead.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay, so I have a piece to throw out there and see if we can talk about it. Here goes. So if, you know, let's say I'm in a relationship with a friend, we are really close, and then something happens that upsets us. Okay, so let's put me as the person that was offended or upset or whatever. And I'm offended or upset by something that happened between us. Now, in a counseling setting, we might talk about, well, what was it that triggered you, right? And we would zero in on the thing that offended me. But like, was it the way they said it, the thing they did? Sometimes we go down the road of, talking to other people about it and trying to gain allies and saying why I'm justified in being offended or why I'm justified in being upset.
Well, it sets up such a binary.
Yeah, it does. It does. But I think there's a piece that we never practice. And that is, and it's very hard to do. It's hard for me to do. You remove yourself from the situation and you look at it. And you look at it as like, what was it? Was it a word they said? Was it a way they did something that was offensive to me? And what is that representing to me? And now it's no longer about that other person doing something intentionally to hurt me, right? It's something that they did. Maybe it was re-traumatizing for me. And the important part that I want to share and talk about is they couldn't have known that that would have upset me. Unless it was intentional, but I think that's rare.
Right.
I don't think people are walking around trying to harm people. But it has to do with my context and something I've been through that you brought up unintentionally.
And there's something about my context that would have led me to use those words that you probably don't know about. I mean, if we're going to set up our ideal of what we would hope people would do, they would want to know about each other's context that A, makes saying it in that way reasonable, and B, makes experiencing hearing it reasonable.
So you're saying reasonable. Maybe you can talk more about that, because I don't want to put out an idea out there that we would say, oh, yeah, no, it's fine that you screamed at me and called me all these curse words. But right. Which is different saying that's okay versus it's reasonable that you did that.
Right. By reasonable, I just mean we would have an understanding of someone's context such that it makes sense as a wise way to deliver the information or make sense of the information.
And context meaning?
Experiences, memories, hopes, fears, past relationships, anything.
Okay, then let's go back to the example. My friend and I had a falling out and I'm really upset. If that friend had known my past experiences, hopes, dreams, failures, whatever, surrounding this issue, are you saying that they might recognize why I was triggered?
Yeah. Okay. Well, more importantly, if they had that information, I think the assumption a lot of people would make is that they would have intentionally chosen a different way to say something to you.
Of course, yeah, right.
But I don't think it's intentional. I think if they had the information about that context, whatever they said would have just been something else.
Yeah.
Not because they sat and made a decision, do I want to hurt Carrie or do I want to support her? I don't think it was an intentional decision, but without that context, whatever they communicate is just going to be a reasonable product for whatever context they do have. And if your context was part of theirs, something else would have come out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The other half of this that comes up when I think about it is that when we hear those things, and this is kind of what you were saying, they could be opportunities to get better at extracting the meaning from them rather than getting better at correcting the other person.
Right. So, okay, so here's the sustainable part of relationships is that the sharing of the context and the vulnerability of doing so. So in the same example, I could choose to take the risk, go to my friend who has upset me, for lack of better words, and say, you couldn't have known this, but when you said or did, you know, that thing you did, and then I got very upset, I need you to know that it really reminded me of something that's happened to me before. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I went down the slippery slope of, oh, okay, so now if you're, you know, acting this way and it's going to end up here, and I cut you out of the dialogue by getting upset, but I want to share with you why it was so painful for me. And that's not something we do in our conversations generally. Right. Now, I know a lot of my friends are practicing therapists, so maybe that happens more often. But it's not something that we can't just do outside of a therapy field. I mean, we do this in our families with our friends and with our loved ones.
Right. And to keep using your example, I think the process might be twofold. So there's the half that you just named about you explaining the context for how whatever she said was received and what it reminded you of and how you made sense of it.
Who said she?
Did I say she?
Yeah. Huh. Ooh, assumptions.
Maybe. There's our next show.
Right.
Why did Dan say she?
Why did
she?
Dan decide that it was a girl?
Anyway, we can
try
check
to remain
the tape.
Gender neutral.
So
protecting confidentiality.
They,
what if this really happened?
Then I hope she's listening. But the second half of that would be you investigating why those were the words she said. How did she come to that statement?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm oversimplifying. I don't know if it was just a statement, but
right.
What information was she computing that came out in those words?
Yeah, it's on both sides. The context matters on both sides, which, I don't know, brings me to like a philosophical moment in my mind of it's arbitrary who these people are. It's arbitrary the words that were said.
Totally.
It doesn't matter. And if we can hold in our minds very loosely that relationships are based off of two people bringing completely different contexts, different experiences, different hopes, different judgments to the same conversation or interaction, we will trigger each other. It's
right.
Unavoidable.
Right.
And as that happens, now think about this in therapeutic context, a therapist and a client, right? So a client is doing something very vulnerable. They're being a client. The therapist is doing something vulnerable too, if they're sharing of themselves or trying to help someone,
right.
And they don't have all the answers, right? So then that's a highly charged situation, and there are triggering things that are going to happen. And I think this is the point of why we even include this topic on the show, is that we can have a rupture in therapy, but the repair happens. And why does it happen in therapy when it maybe doesn't happen in real life? Well, we have that weekly commitment, right? And we're going to go and sit down for 1 hour. We've reserved to do what? Work on our relationship.
Right.
And in that working on the relationship, you're gaining valuable experience of what it's like to be triggered or to trigger and to dissect or deconstruct what happened and what
right.
part of your context was brought up in that and why is it relevant. And then, of course, you can take that to other relationships in your life, but I don't think you're taking the healing part of, oh, she understands me now, you know. You're taking the experience of what it's like to repair.
Yeah, that brings up a really important point, I think, about the practice of counseling. Because if a counselor doesn't model that process, repairing ruptures, which means you have to allow for ruptures, which means mm-hmm. you have to have been transparent enough to find the disagreements to, right, to honestly let a rupture happen, then someone's not learning those skills from therapy.
Right, right.
And the flip side of that is that they'd be getting a very artificial experience of somebody that never disagrees, never tells them they think they're wrong, never mm-hmm. ruptures. And it's teaching them that that's what a relationship should feel like when it's working well out in the real world.
Aha, uh-huh, but
it never does.
I'm going to bring up right now.
Sure.
Is that what I hear most often of people go, oh, I really need to go see a therapist. Well, why would you want to do that? Why do you want to go talk to a therapist? Because they are unbiased, because they will listen, because they will understand, because they will make me feel better. These are a lot of the answers I've heard.
Absolutely.
Right, very, very common answers and are modeled on television. We go to therapy because we are we can't talk to anybody in our life. I can't tell you how many clients I've seen. They say, I can't talk to anybody but you. Right. And it's like, really? Because I challenge you all the time. This isn't always fun, right? It's not always.
Well, you're speaking to an invisible factor there, which is building the support in the therapeutic relationship to practice that way.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what your experience has been, but if I work with somebody that starts with that perspective, I'm coming to therapy because you're unbiased, you'll just listen, et cetera, et cetera. I point out that it's impossible, and then I build the foundation so that when that doesn't actually happen and we disagree and we rupture, we can repair.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been my experience that maybe 1 out of 10 or more, 1 out of 20, are not interested once they've had the experience of the relationship supporting a rupture or supporting the ability to repair a rupture.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people look back and say, no, I don't want that. I want to go back to you just listening and me pretending you're unbiased.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. No, but it brings me back to what I said in the beginning. So there's the investment. This relationship is not on the table.
Right.
Right. I'm making an investment to stay, whether we rupture, whether we repair slowly or right away, whether you're hurt or I'm hurt, this is going to happen. I'm acknowledging it and I'm going to hang in there.
Right.
You know, obviously relationships end when they get to a point where people feel nothing can be resolved, but I don't know, maybe I'm overly hopeful in thinking that almost any situation could be, even quite severe ones.
I think a lot could.
And I'm referencing things like, you know, infidelity, things like that, or other really strong life events. You have to have the commitment and the investment.
Absolutely. So I'm looking at the time, and I think we should wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
God, I sound like such a therapist just then.
That was I'm horrible. Noticing the time.
And that's a good point. Not everything is going to be fixed by this. I hope nobody listening imagines that we're throwing out some magic wand here. But in my experience, at least 2/3 of relationship struggles would be greatly improved by thinking this way.
I agree. And I am actually very suspicious of any therapeutic model that is holding the assumption of like listening is
right. Right. This most unbiased, right. Unconditional listening. Yeah.
Right. Not that listening isn't a huge part of therapy.
Sure.
However, the investment in, you know, approaching the elephants in the room is so important.
Totally. And if you ask me to have good empathetic listening, it has to be active and it has to be dialogic.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just sort of trying to be a neutral listener, I don't think that's really good listening. You could be a good scribe. You could be a good note taker. But you might not be very engaged with that work.
Right. Now, how could you be?
Do you have anything you want to check out with?
Yeah, I have one piece, and it's that rupture, repair. If you're in any type of a relationship, you're having any kind of relational struggle, I don't want to put out there that I have advice. Like you were just saying, like, no, this is how you can fix it and that kind of things. Everything has its own context to consider. But I think I want to put out the piece of hope is that in every experience I've had where there's been rupture, if there's repair, the relationship is transformed after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm willing to approach the difficult things in my relationships because I know that there might be rupture, but I always have that hope that it will be so much better. And that's always worth it to me because confrontation's hard. That it will be repaired if there's a commitment, right?
Right. Well, that checkout reminds me of a checkout, or it inspires one, rather. Because I do think the commitment's important, and I wonder if people just imagined that they're committing to being civil, empathetic human beings to each other. Mm-hmm. That might make repairing rupture more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
No, that person might not be your partner. You might not get married and have 10 babies or whatever, but is it worthwhile to commit to being a civil, empathetic human being to them?
Yeah, good point. Well, I'd like to thank our listeners, and if you have any questions or comments, please send them to us, and thanks for listening to Fire Your Therapist. Fire Your Therapist is brought to you by Yumi Media. Yumi Media offers a very custom production solution with quite intentional design. I can say for myself that when we started Fire Your Therapist, we really only had an idea. When we approached Yumi Media, they took care of everything else, everything. They designed our logos, they put us on iTunes, made a website. They made it possible for us to not only record the audio, but they brought the equipment. And although we're a small-scale production based in Los Angeles, you know, Yumi Media is based in Los Angeles, so it was not only convenient for us, but I know that they work overseas. They travel for different, you know, large-scale productions like conferences. They bring everything, lighting, video, audio, photography, anything that you would need for any sort of production or conference. They bring it, and then when they're done, they do post-production, editing, audio, video, everything. You really only need to have an idea. So if you have a project that you're looking to work on, please contact Yumi Media, send in your questions, and they'll let you know how that they can work with you in a very custom way that fits exactly what you're trying to do on your project. They really honor your ideas, and I think that that's the best part about them. Please contact them at info@yumimedia.com or go to their website, yumimedia.com, and that's spelled YOUMIMEDIA.com. You can also call them 310-989-0138.
Fire Your Therapist was produced by Yumi Media. Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or go to fireyourtherapistshow.com where you can find podcasts, resources, and more.